Iota, just at the edge of the Twin Rivers ghetto. I noticed a discolored outline on the building's facade where the Hilton logo used to be, back when the place had been a hotel. I thumbed my fare and climbed out of the cab. Then I took one last look around, inhaled one final breath of fresh air, and carried my bag through the front door and into the lobby. When I stepped inside the security checkpoint cage, my fingerprints and retinal patterns were scanned, and my new name flashed on the monitor. A green light lit up, and the cage door slid open, allowing me to continue on to the elevators. My apartment was on the 42nd floor, number 4211. The security lock mounted outside required another retinal scan. Then, the door slid open, and the interior light switched on. There was no furniture in the cube-shaped room, and only one window. I stepped inside, closed the door, and locked it behind me. Then, I made a silent vow not to go outside again until I had completed my quest. I would abandon the real world altogether until I found the egg. Level 2. I'm not crazy about reality, but it's still the only place to get a decent meal. Groucho Marx. Chapter 17. Artemis.
You there?
Parzival.
Yes! Hey, I can't believe you finally responded to one of my chat requests.
Artemis.
Only to ask you to cut it out. It's a bad idea for us to start chatting.
Parzival.
Why? I thought we were friends.
Artemis,
you seem like a great guy, but we're competitors, rival Gunters, sworn enemies. You know the drill.
Parzival,
we don't have to talk about anything related to the hunt.
Artemis, everything is related to the hunt.
Parzival, come on, at least give it a shot.
Let's start over.
Hi, Artemis, how have you been?
Artemis,
fine, thanks for asking. You?
Parzival,
outstanding. Listen, why are we using this ancient text-only chat interface? I can host a virtual chat room for us.
Artemis,
I prefer this.
Parzival,
why?
Artemis,
as you may recall, I tend to ramble in real time. When I have to type out everything I want to say, I come off as less of a flibbertigibbet.
Parzival,
I don't think you're a flibbertigibbet. You're enchanting.
Artemis, did you just use the word enchanting?
Parzival, what I typed is right there in front of you, isn't it?
Artemis, that's very sweet, but you're full of crap.
Parzival, I am totally and completely serious.
Artemis, so, how's life at the top of the scoreboard, hotshot? Sick of being famous yet?
Parzival, I don't feel famous.
Artemis, are you kidding? The whole world is dying to find out who you really are. You're a rock star, man.
Parzival, you're just as famous as I am. And if I'm such a rock star, how come the media always portrays me as some unwashed geek who never goes outside?
Artemis, I take it you saw that SNL skit they did about us?
Parzival,
yes.
Why does everyone assume I'm an antisocial nut job?
Artemis, you're not antisocial?
Parzival,
no.
Maybe?
Okay, yes.
But I have excellent personal hygiene.
Artemis, at least they got your gender correct. Everyone thinks I'm a man in real life.
Parzival, that's because most Gunters are male and they can't accept the idea that a woman has beaten and or outsmarted them.
Artemis, I know, Neanderthals.
Parzival, so, you're telling me definitively that you are a female, IRL?
Artemis, you should have already figured that out on your own, Clouseau.
Parzival,
I did. I have.
Artemis,
have you?
Parzival,
yes. After analyzing the available data, I have concluded that you must be a female.
Artemis, why must I?
Parzival, because I don't want to find out that I've got a crush on some 300-pound dude named Chuck who lives in his mother's basement in suburban Detroit.
Artemis, you've got a crush on me?
Parzival,
you should have already figured that out on your own, Clouseau. Artemis, what if I were a 300-pound gal named Charlene who lives in her mom's basement in suburban Detroit? Would you still have a crush on me then? Parzival, I don't know. Do you live in your mother's basement? Artemis, no. Parzival, yeah, then I probably still would. Artemis, so I'm supposed to believe you're one of those mythical guys who only cares about a woman's personality and not about the package it comes in? Parzival, why is it that you assume I'm a man? Artemis, please, it's obvious. I get nothing but boy vibes coming from you. Parzival, boy vibes? What, do I use masculine sentence structure or something? Artemis, don't change the subject. You were saying you have a crush on me? Parzival, I've had a crush on you since before we even met. From reading your blog and watching your POV, I've been cyberstalking you for years. Artemis, but you still don't really know anything about me or my real personality. Parzival, this is the Oasis. We exist as nothing but raw personality in here. Artemis, I beg to differ. Everything about our online personas is filtered through our avatars, which allows us to control how we look and sound to others. The Oasis lets you be whoever you want to be. That's why everyone is addicted to it. Parzival, so IRL, you're nothing like the person I met that night in the tomb? Artemis, that was just one side of me, the side I chose to show you. Parzival, well, I liked that side. And if you showed me your other sides, I'm sure I'd like those too. Artemis, you say that now, but I know how these things work. Sooner or later, you'll demand to see a picture of the real me. Parzival, I'm not the sort who makes demands. Besides, I'm definitely not going to show you a photo of me. Artemis, why? Are you butt ugly? Parzival, you're such a hypocrite. Artemis, so? Answer the question, Claire. Are you ugly? Parzival, I must be. Artemis, why? Parzival, the female of the species has always found me repellent. Artemis, I don't find you repellent. Parzival, of course not. That's because you're an obese man named Chuck who likes to chat up ugly young boys online. Artemis, so you're a young man? Parzival, relatively young. Artemis, relative to what? Parzival, to a 53-year-old guy like you, Chuck. Does your mom let you live in that basement rent-free or what? Artemis, is that really what you're picturing? Parzival, if it were, I wouldn't be chatting with you right now. Artemis, so what do you imagine I look like then? Parzival, like your avatar, I suppose. Except, you know, without the armor, guns, or glowing sword. Artemis, you're kidding, right? That's the first rule of online romances, pal. No one ever looks anything like their avatar. Parzival, are we going to have an online romance? Crosses fingers. Artemis, no way, Ace. Sorry. Parzival, why not? Artemis, no time for love, Dr. Jones. My cyber porn addiction eats up most of my free time. And searching for the jade key takes up the rest. That's what I should be doing right now, in fact. Parzival, yeah, so should I. But talking to you is more fun. Artemis, how about you? Parzival, how about me what? Artemis, do you have time for an online romance? Parzival, I've got time for you. Artemis, you're too much. Parzival, I'm not even laying it on thick yet. Artemis, do you have a job or are you still in high school? Parzival, high school. I graduate next week. Artemis, you shouldn't reveal stuff like that. I could be a Sixer spy trying to profile you. Parzival, the Sixers already profiled me, remember? They blew up my house. Well, it was a trailer. But they blew it up. Artemis, I know. I'm still freaked out about that. I can only imagine how you feel. Parzival, revenge is a dish best served cold. Artemis, bon appetit. What do you do when you're not hunting? Parzival, I refuse to answer any more questions until you start reciprocating. Artemis, fine. Quid pro quo, Dr. Lecter. We'll take turns asking questions. Go ahead. Parzival, do you work or go to school? Artemis, college. Parzival, studying what? Artemis, it's my turn. What do you do when you're not hunting?
Parzival, nothing. Hunting is all I do. I'm hunting right now, in fact. Multitasking all over the goddamn place.
Artemis, same here.
Parzival, really?
I'll keep an eye on the scoreboard then, just in case.
Artemis, you do that, Ace.
Parzival, what are you studying in college?
Artemis, poetry and creative writing.
Parzival, that makes sense. You're a fantastic writer.
Artemis, thanks for the compliment. How old are you?
Parzival, just turned 18 last month. You?
Artemis, don't you think we're getting a little too personal now?
Parzival, not even remotely.
Artemis, 19.
Parzival, ah, an older woman. Hot.
Artemis, that is, if I am a woman.
Parzival, are you a woman?
Artemis, it's not your turn.
Parzival, fine.
Artemis, how old do you know H?
Parzival, he's been my best friend for 5 years. Now, spill it.
Are you a woman?
And by that, I mean, are you a human female who has never had a sex change operation?
Artemis, that's pretty specific.
Parzival, answer the question, Claire.
Artemis, I am, and always have been, a human female.
Have you ever met H, IRL?
Parzival, no.
Do you have any siblings?
Artemis, no. You?
Parzival, nope.
You got parents?
Artemis, they died, the flu, so I was raised by my grandparents.
You got parentage?
Parzival, no, mine are dead too.
Artemis, it kind of sucks, doesn't it, not having your parents around?
Parzival, yeah, but a lot of people are worse off than me.
Artemis, I tell myself that all the time.
So, are you and H working as a duo?
Parzival, oh, here we go.
Artemis, well, are you?
Parzival, no.
He asked me the same thing about you and me, you know, because you cleared the first gate a few hours after I did.
Artemis,
which reminds me, why did you give me that tip about changing sides on the joust game?
Parzival,
I felt like helping you.
Artemis, well, you shouldn't make that mistake again, because I'm the one who's going to win. You do realize that, right?
Parzival, yeah, yeah, we'll see.
Artemis, you're not holding up your end of our Q&A, goof. You're like 5 questions behind.
Parzival, fine. What color is your hair, IRL?
Artemis, brunette.
Parzival, eyes?
Artemis, blue.
Parzival, just like your avatar, eh? Do you have the same face and body, too?
Artemis, as far as you know.
Parzival, okay. What's your favorite movie of all time?
Artemis, it changes. Right now, probably Highlander.
Parzival, you've got great taste, lady.
Artemis, I know. I have a thing for evil, bald, bad guys. The Kurgan is too sexy.
Parzival, I'm going to shave my head right now and start wearing leather.
Artemis,
send photos. Listen, I gotta go in a few minutes, Romeo. You can ask me one last question, then I need to get some sleep.
Parzival, when can we chat again?
Artemis, after one of us finds the egg.
Parzival, that could take years.
Artemis, so be it.
Parzival, can I at least keep emailing you?
Artemis, not a good idea.
Parzival, you can't stop me from emailing you.
Artemis, actually, I can. I can block you on my contact list.
Parzival, you wouldn't do that, though.
Would you?
Artemis, not if you don't force me to.
Parzival, harsh, unnecessarily harsh.
Artemis, good night, Parzival.
Parzival, farewell, Artemis. Sweet dreams. Chat log ends 2:27:2045 02:51:38 OST. I started emailing her. At first, I showed restraint and only wrote her once a week. To my surprise, she never failed to respond. Usually, it was with just a single sentence saying she was too busy to reply. But her replies eventually got longer, and we began to correspond. a few times a week at first. Then, as our emails grew longer and more personal, we started writing each other at least once a day, sometimes more. Whenever an email from her arrived in my inbox, I dropped everything to read it. Before long, we were meeting in private chat room sessions at least once a day. We played vintage board games, watched movies, and listened to music. We talked for hours, long, rambling conversations about everything under the sun. Spending time with her was intoxicating. We seemed to have everything in common. We shared the same interests. We were driven by the same goal. She got all of my jokes. She made me laugh. She made me think. She changed the way I saw the world. I'd never had such a powerful, immediate connection with another human being before, not even with H. I no longer cared that we were supposed to be rivals, and she didn't seem to either. We began to share details about our research. We told each other what movies we were currently watching and what books we were reading. We even began to exchange theories and to discuss our interpretations of specific passages in the almanac. I couldn't make myself be cautious around her. A little voice in my head kept trying to tell me that every word she said could be disinformation and that she might just be playing me for a fool, but I didn't believe it. I trusted her, even though I had every reason not to. I graduated from high school in early June. I didn't attend the graduation ceremony. I'd stopped attending classes altogether when I fled the stacks. As far as I knew, the Sixers thought I was dead, and I didn't want to tip them off by showing up for my last few weeks of school. Missing finals week wasn't a big deal, since I already had more than enough credits to receive my diploma. The school emailed a copy of it to me. They snail-mailed the actual diploma to my address in the stacks, which no longer existed, so I don't know what became of it. When I finished school, I'd intended to devote all of my time to the hunt, but all I really wanted to do was spend time with Artemis. When I wasn't hanging out with my new online pseudo-girlfriend, I devoted the rest of my time to leveling up my avatar. Gunters called this making the climb to 99, because 99th level was the maximum power level an avatar could attain. Artemis and H had both recently done it, and I felt compelled to catch up. It actually didn't take me very long. I now had nothing but free time, and I had the money and the means to fully explore the Oasis. So I began to complete every quest I could find, sometimes jumping 5 or 6 levels in one day. I became a split-class warrior mage. As my stats continued to increase, I honed my avatar's combat and spellcasting abilities while collecting a wide array of powerful weapons, magic items, and vehicles. Artemis and I even teamed up for a few quests. We visited the planet Goondocks and finished the entire Goonies quest in just one day. Artie played through it as Martha Plimpton's character, Steph, while I played as Mikey, Sean Astin's character. It was entirely too much fun. I didn't spend all of my time goofing off. I tried to keep my head in the game. Really, I did. At least once a day I would pull up the quatrain and try once again to decipher its meaning. The captain conceals the jade key in a dwelling long neglected. But you can only blow the whistle once the trophies are all collected. For a while I thought that the whistle in the third line might be a reference to a late 60s Japanese TV show called The Space Giants, which had been dubbed in English and rebroadcast in the United States in the 70s and 80s. The Space Giants, called Maguma Taishi in Japan, featured a family of transforming robots who lived in a volcano and battled an evil alien villain named Rodak. Halliday referred to this show several times in Anorak's Almanac, citing it as one of his childhood favorites. One of the show's main characters was a boy named Miko, who would blow a special whistle to summon the robots to his aid. I watched all 52 ultra-cheesy episodes of The Space Giants back-to-back while wolfing down corn chips and taking notes. But when the viewing marathon was over, I still wasn't any closer to understanding the quatrain's meaning. I'd hit another dead end. I decided that Halliday must be referring to some other whistle. Then, one Saturday morning, I finally made a small breakthrough. I was watching a collection of vintage 80s cereal commercials when I paused to wonder why cereal manufacturers no longer included toy prizes inside every box. It was a tragedy, in my opinion, another sign that civilization was going straight down the tubes. I was still pondering this when an old Cap'n Crunch commercial came on, and that was when I made a connection between the first and third lines of the quatrain. The captain conceals the jade key, but you can only blow the whistle. Halliday was alluding to a famous 70s hacker named John Draper, better known by the alias Captain Crunch. Draper was one of the first phone freaks, and he was famous for discovering that the toy plastic whistles found as prizes in boxes of Cap'n Crunch cereal could be used to make free long-distance phone calls, because they emitted a 2600 Hz tone that tricked the old analog phone system into giving you free access to the line. The captain conceals the jade key. That had to be it. The captain was Cap'n Crunch, and the whistle was the famous toy plastic whistle of phone freak lore. Maybe the jade key was disguised as one of those toy plastic whistles, and it was hidden in a box of Cap'n Crunch cereal. But where was that cereal box hidden? In a dwelling long neglected. I still didn't know what long-neglected dwelling that line referred to or where to look for it. I visited every neglected dwelling I could think of, recreations of the Addams Family House, the abandoned shack in the Evil Dead trilogy, Tyler Durden's Flophouse and Fight Club, and the Lars homestead on Tatooine. No luck finding the jade key inside any of them. Dead end after dead end. But you can only blow the whistle once the trophies are all collected. I still hadn't deciphered the meaning of that last line either. What trophies did I have to collect? Or was that some kind of half-assed metaphor? There had to be a simple connection I wasn't making, a sly reference that I still wasn't clever or knowledgeable enough to catch. Since then, I'd failed to make any more progress. Every time I revisited the quatrain, my ongoing infatuation with Artemis would undermine my ability to focus, and before long, I would close my Grail diary and call her up to see if she wanted to hang out. She almost always did. I convinced myself that it was all right to slack off a bit, because no one else seemed to be making any progress in their search for the jade key. The scoreboard remained unchanged. Everyone else seemed to be just as stumped as I was. As the weeks continued to pass, Artemis and I spent more and more time together. Even when our avatars were doing other things, we were sending emails and instant messages to each other. A river of words flowed between us. I wanted more than anything to meet her in the real world, face to face. But I didn't tell her this. I was certain she had strong feelings for me, but she also kept me at a distance. No matter how much I revealed about myself to her, and I wound up revealing just about everything, including my real name, she always adamantly refused to reveal any details about her own life. All I knew was that she was 19 and that she lived somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. That was all she would tell me. The image of her that formed in my mind was the most obvious one. I pictured her as a physical manifestation of her avatar. I imagined her with the same face, eyes, hair, and body. Even though she told me repeatedly that in reality she looked almost nothing like her avatar and that she wasn't nearly as attractive in person. When I began to spend most of my time with Artemis, H and I began to grow apart. Instead of hanging out several times a week, we chatted a few times a month. H knew I was falling for Artemis, but he never gave me too much grief about it, even when I would bail on him at the last minute to hang out with her instead. He would just shrug, tell me to be careful, and say,
I sure hope you know what you're doing, Z. I didn't, of course. My whole relationship with Artemis was in defiance of all common sense. But I couldn't help falling for her. Somehow, without my realizing it, my obsession with finding Halliday's Easter egg was gradually being supplanted by my obsession with Artemis. Eventually, she and I began to go out on dates, taking day trips to exotic oasis locales and exclusive night spots. At first, Artemis protested. She thought I should keep a low profile, because as soon as my avatar was spotted in public, the Sixers would know that their attempt to kill me had failed, and I'd be back on their hit list. But I told her I no longer cared. I was already hiding from the Sixers in the real world, and I refused to continue hiding from them in the Oasis, too. Besides, I had a 99th level avatar now. I felt nigh invincible. Maybe I was just trying to impress Artemis by acting fearless. If so, I think it worked. We still disguised our avatars before we went out, because we knew there would be tabloid headlines galore if Parzival and Artemis started showing up in public together on a regular basis. But there was one exception. One night, she took me to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show in a huge, stadium-sized movie theater on the planet Transsexual, where they held the most highly attended and longest-running weekly screening of the movie in the Oasis. Thousands of avatars came to every show to sit in the stands and revel in the audience participation. Normally, only long-standing members of the Rocky Horror fan club were permitted to get up on stage and help act out the film in front of the giant movie screen, and only after they'd passed a grueling audition process. But Artemis used her fame to pull a few strings, and she and I were both allowed to join the cast for that night's show. The whole planet was in a no PvP zone, so I wasn't worried about getting ambushed by the Sixers. But I did have a serious case of stage fright when the show began. Artemis played a note-perfect Columbia, and I had the honor of playing her undead love interest, Eddie. I altered my avatar's appearance so that I looked exactly like Meatloaf did in the role, but my performance and lip-syncing still kinda sucked. Luckily, the audience cut me a lot of slack because I was the famous Gunter Parzival, and I was clearly having a blast. That night was easily the most fun I'd ever had in my life up to that point. I told Artemis so afterward, and that was when she leaned over and kissed me for the first time. I couldn't feel it, of course, but it still set my heart racing. I'd heard all the cliched warnings about the perils of falling for someone you only knew online, but I ignored them. I decided that whoever Artemis really was, I was in love with her. I could feel it, deep in the soft, chewy caramel center of my being. And then, one night, like a complete idiot, I told her how I felt. Chapter 18. It was a Friday night, and I was spending another solitary evening doing research, working my way through every episode of WizKids, an early 80s TV show about a teenage hacker who uses his computer skills to solve mysteries. I just finished watching the episode Deadly Access, a crossover with Simon and Simon, when an email arrived in my inbox. It was from Ogden Morrow. The subject line read, "We can dance if we want to." There was no text in the body of the email, just a file attachment. An invitation to one of the most exclusive gatherings in the Oasis, Ogden Morrow's birthday party. In the real world, Morrow almost never made public appearances, and in the Oasis, he came out of hiding only once a year to host this event. The invitation featured a photo of Morrow's world-famous avatar, the great and powerful Og. The gray-bearded wizard was hunched over an elaborate DJ mixing board, one headphone pressed to his ear, biting his lower lip in auditory ecstasy as his fingers scratched ancient vinyl on a set of silver turntables. His record crate bore a "Don't Panic" sticker and an anti-Sixer logo,
a yellow number 6 with a red circle and slash over it. The text at the bottom read, "Ogden Morrow's 80s dance party in celebration of his 73rd birthday. Tonight, 10 p.m. OST at the Distracted Globe, Admit 1. I was flabbergasted. Ogden Morrow had actually taken the time to invite me to his birthday party. It felt like the greatest honor I'd ever received. I called Artemis, and she confirmed that she'd received the same email. She said she couldn't pass up an invitation from Og himself, despite the obvious risks. So, naturally, I told her I would meet her there at the club. It was the only way I could avoid looking like a total wuss. I knew that if Og had invited the two of us, he'd probably also invited the other members of the High Five. But H probably wouldn't show up because he competed in a globally televised arena death match every Friday night. And Shoto and Daito never entered a PvP zone unless it was absolutely necessary. The Distracted Globe was a famous zero-gravity dance club on the planet Neo Noir in Sector 16. Ogden Morrow had coded the place himself decades ago and was still its sole owner. I'd never visited the globe before. I wasn't much for dancing and for socializing with the twinked-out wannabe Gunter Uber dorks who were known to frequent the place. But Og's birthday party was a special event, and so the usual clientele would be banished for the evening. Tonight, the club would be packed with celebrities, movie stars, musicians, and at least two members of the High Five. I spent over an hour tweaking my avatar's hair and trying on different skins to wear to the club. I finally settled on some classic 80s-era attire, a light gray suit, exactly like the one Peter Weller wore in Buckaroo Banzai, complete with a red bow tie, along with a pair of vintage white Adidas high tops. I also loaded my inventory with my best suit of body armor and a large amount of weaponry. One of the reasons the Globe was such a hip, exclusive club was because it was located in a PvP zone, one where both magic and technology functioned. So it was extremely dangerous to go there, especially for a famous gunter like me. There were hundreds of cyberpunk-themed worlds spread throughout the Oasis, but Neo Noir was one of the largest and oldest. Seen from orbit, the planet was a shiny onyx marble covered in overlapping spider webs of pulsating light. It was always night on Neo Noir, the world over, and its surface was an uninterrupted grid of interconnected cities packed with impossibly large skyscrapers. Its skies were filled with a continuous stream of flying vehicles whirring through the vertical cityscapes. And the streets below teemed with leather-clad NPCs and mirror-shaded avatars, all sporting high-tech weaponry and subcutaneous implants as they spouted city-speak straight out of Neuromancer. The Distracted Globe was located at the Western Hemisphere intersection of the Boulevard and the Avenue, two brightly lit streets that stretched completely around the planet along its equator and prime meridian. The club itself was a massive cobalt-blue sphere, 3 kilometers in diameter, floating 30 meters off the ground. A floating crystal staircase led up to the club's only entrance, a circular opening at the bottom of the sphere. I made a big entrance when I arrived in my flying DeLorean, which I'd obtained by completing a Back to the Future quest on the planet Zemeckis. The DeLorean came outfitted with a non-functioning flux capacitor, but I'd made several additions to its equipment and appearance. First, I'd installed an artificially intelligent onboard computer named Kit, purchased in an online auction, into the dashboard, along with a matching red Knight Rider scanner just above the DeLorean's grille. Then, I'd outfitted the car with an oscillation overthruster, a device that allowed it to travel through solid matter. Finally, to complete my 80s super vehicle theme, I'd slapped a Ghostbusters logo on each of the DeLorean's gullwing doors, then added personalized plates that read, Ecto-88. I'd had it only a few weeks now, but my time-traveling, ghost-busting, night-riding, matter-penetrating DeLorean had already become my avatar's trademark. I knew that leaving my sweet ride parked in a PvP zone was an open invitation for some moron to try to boost it. The DeLorean had several anti-theft systems installed, and the ignition system was booby-trapped, Max Rockatansky style, so that if any other avatar tried to start the car, the plutonium chamber would detonate in a small thermonuclear explosion. But keeping my car safe wouldn't be a problem here on Neo Noir. As soon as I climbed out of the DeLorean, I cast a shrink spell on it, instantly reducing it to the size of a matchbox car. Then, I put the DeLorean in my pocket. Magic zones had their advantages. Thousands of avatars were packed up against the velvet rope force fields that kept everyone without an invitation at bay. As I walked toward the entrance, the crowd bombarded me with a mix of insults, autograph requests, death threats, and tearful declarations of undying love. I had my body shield activated, but surprisingly, no one took a shot at me. I flashed the cyborg doorman my invitation, then mounted the long crystal staircase leading up into the club. Entering the distracted globe was more than a little disorienting. The inside of the giant sphere was completely hollow, and its curved interior surface served as the club's bar and lounge area. The moment you passed through the entrance, the laws of gravity changed. No matter where you walked, your avatar's feet always adhered to the interior of the sphere, so you could walk in a straight line up to the top of the club, then back down the other side, ending up right back where you started. The huge open space in the center of the sphere served as the club's zero-gravity dance floor. You reached it simply by jumping off the ground, like Superman taking flight, and then swimming through the air into the spherical zero-G groove zone. As I stepped through the entrance, I glanced up, or in the direction that was currently up to me at the moment, and took a long look around. The place was packed. Hundreds of avatars milled around like ants crawling around the inside of a giant balloon. Others were already out on the dance floor, spinning, flying, twisting, and tumbling in time with the music, which thumped out of floating spherical speakers that drifted throughout the club. In the middle of all the dancers, a large clear bubble was suspended in space at the absolute center of the club. This was the booth where the DJ stood, surrounded by turntables, mixers, decks, and dials. At the center of all that gear was the opening DJ, R2-D2, hard at work, using his various robotic arms to work the turntables. I recognized the tune he was playing, the 88 remix of New Order's Blue Monday, with a lot of Star Wars droid sound samples mixed in. As I made my way to the nearest bar, the avatars I passed all stopped to stare and point in my direction. I didn't pay them much notice because I was busy scanning the club for Artemis. When I reached the bar, I ordered a pan-galactic gargle blaster from the female Klingon bartender and downed half of it. Then I grinned as R2 queued up another classic 80s tune. "Union of the Snake," I recited, mostly out of habit. "Duran Duran. 1983. "Not bad, Ace," said a familiar voice, speaking just loud enough to be heard over the music. I turned to see Artemis standing behind me. She was wearing evening attire, a gunmetal blue dress that looked like it was spray-painted on. Her avatar's dark hair was styled in a pageboy cut, perfectly framing her gorgeous face. She looked devastating. She shouted at the barkeep, "Glenn Morangi, on the rocks." I smiled to myself. Connor McLeod's favorite drink. Man, did I love this girl. She winked at me as her drink appeared. Then she clinked her glass against mine and downed its contents in one swallow. The chattering of the avatars around us grew in volume. Word that Parzival and Artemis were here, chatting each other up at the bar, was already spreading through the entire club. Artemis glanced up at the dance floor, then back at me.
"So, how about it, Percy?" she said. "Feel like cutting a rug?"
I scowled. "Not if you keep calling me Percy." She laughed. Just then, the current song ended, and the club grew silent. All eyes turned upward toward the DJ booth, where R2-D2 was currently dissolving in a shower of light, like someone beaming out in an original Star Trek episode. Then, a huge cheer went up as a familiar gray-haired avatar beamed in, appearing behind the turntables. It was Og. Hundreds of vidfeed windows materialized in the air all over the club. Each displayed a live close-up image of Og in the booth so that everyone could see his avatar clearly. The old wizard was wearing baggy jeans, sandals, and a faded Star Trek The Next Generation t-shirt. He waved to the assembled, then queued up his first track, a dance remix of Rebel Yell by Billy Idol. A cheer swept across the dance floor.
"I love this song!" Artemis shouted. Her eyes darted up to the dance floor. I looked at her uncertainly.
"What's wrong?" she said with mock sympathy. "Can't the boy dance?"
She abruptly locked into the beat, bobbing her head, gyrating her hips. Then she pushed off from the floor with both feet and began to float upward, drifting toward the groove zone. I stared up at her, temporarily frozen, mustering my courage. "All right," I muttered to myself. "What the hell?" I bent my knees and pushed off hard from the floor. My avatar took flight, drifting upward and sliding alongside Artemis. The avatars who were already on the dance floor moved aside to clear a path for us, a tunnel leading to the center of the dance floor. I could see Og hovering in his bubble just a short distance above us. He was spinning around like a dervish, remixing the song on the fly while simultaneously adjusting the gravity vortex of the dance floor so that he was actually spinning the club itself like an ancient vinyl disc. Artemis winked at me, and then her legs melted together to form a mermaid's tail. She flapped her new tail fin once and shot ahead of me, her body undulating and thrusting in time with the machine gun beat as she swam through the air. Then she spun back around to face me, suspended and floating, smiling and holding out her hand, beckoning me to join her. Her hair floated in a halo around her head like she was underwater. When I reached her, she took my hand. As she did, her mermaid tail vanished and her legs reappeared, whirling and scissoring to the beat. Not trusting my instincts any further, I loaded up a piece of high-end avatar dance software called Travoltra, which I downloaded and tested earlier that evening. The program took control of Parzival's movements, syncing them up with the music, and all four of my limbs were transformed into undulating cosine waves. Just like that, I became a dancing fool. Artemis's eyes lit up in surprise and delight, and she began to mirror my movements, the two of us orbiting each other like accelerated electrons. Then, Artemis began shape-shifting. Her avatar lost its human form and dissolved into a pulsing amorphous blob that changed its size and color in sync with the music. I selected the mirror partner option on my dance software and began to do the same. My avatar's limbs and torso began to flow and spin like taffy, encircling Artemis, while strange color patterns flowed and shifted across my skin. I looked like Plastic Man, if he were tripping out of his mind on LSD. Then, everyone else on the dance floor also began to shapeshift, melting into prismatic blobs of light. Soon, the center of the club looked like some otherworldly lava lamp. When the song ended, Og took a bow, then queued up a slow song, Time After Time by Cyndi Lauper. All around us, avatars began to pair up. I gave Artemis a courtly bow and stretched out my hand. She smiled and took it. I pulled her close, and we began to drift together. Og set the dance floor's gravity on a counterclockwise spin, making all of our avatars slowly rotate around the club's invisible central axis, like motes of dust floating inside a snow globe. And then, before I could stop myself, the words just came out. "I'm in love with you, Artie." She didn't respond at first. She just looked at me in shock as our avatars continued to drift in orbit around each other, moving on autopilot. Then she switched to a private voice channel so no one could eavesdrop on our conversation. "You aren't in love with me, Z," she said. "You don't even know me." "Yes, I do," I insisted. "I know you better than I've ever known anyone in my entire life." "You only know what I want you to know. You only see what I want you to see." She placed a hand on her chest. "This isn't my real body, Wade, or my real face." "I don't care. I'm in love with your mind, with the person you are. I couldn't care less about the packaging." "You're just saying that," she said. There was an unsteadiness in her voice. "Trust me, if I ever let you see me in person, you would be repulsed." "Why do you always say that?" "Because I'm hideously deformed, or I'm a paraplegic, or I'm actually 63 years old. Take your pick." "I don't care if you're all three of those things. Tell me where to meet you, and I'll prove it. I'll get on a plane right now and fly to wherever you are. You know I will." She shook her head. "You don't live in the real world, Z. From what you've told me, I don't think you ever have. You're like me. You live inside this illusion." She motioned to our virtual surroundings. "You can't possibly know what real love is." "Don't say that!" I was starting to cry and didn't bother hiding it from her. "Is it because I told you I've never had a real girlfriend and that I'm a virgin? Because of course not," she said. "That isn't what this is about at all." "Then what is it about? Tell me, please." "The hunt. You know that. We've both been neglecting our quests to hang out with each other. We should be focused on finding the Jade Key right now. You can bet that's what Sorrento and the Sixers are doing, and everyone else." "To hell with our competition and the egg," I shouted. "Didn't you hear what I just said? I'm in love with you, and I want to be with you more than anything." She just stared at me. Or rather, her avatar stared blankly back at my avatar. Then she said, "I'm sorry, Z. This is all my fault. I let this get way out of hand. It has to stop." "What do you mean? What has to stop?" "I think we should take a break. Stop spending so much time together." I felt like I'd been punched in the throat. "Are you breaking up with me?" "No, Z," she said firmly. "I am not breaking up with you. That would be impossible because we are not together." There was suddenly venom in her voice. "We've never even met." "So then you're just going to stop talking to me?" "Yes, I think that would be for the best."
"For how long?"
"Until the hunt is over."
"But Artie, that could take years."
"I realize that, and I'm sorry. But this is how it has to be."
"So winning that money is more important to you than me?"
"It's not about the money. It's about what I could do with it."
"Right, saving the world. You're so fucking noble."
"Don't be a jerk," she said. "I've been searching for the egg for over 5 years. So have you. Now we're closer than ever to finding it. I can't just throw my chance away."
"I'm not asking you to."
"Yes, you are. Even if you don't realize it." The Cyndi Lauper song ended, and Og queued up another dance track, "James Brown is Dead" by L.A. Style. The club erupted in applause. I felt like a large wooden stake had been driven into my chest. Artemis was about to say something more. Goodbye, I think. When we heard a thunderous boom directly up above us. At first, I thought it was Og train-wrecking into a new dance track.
But then I looked up and saw the large chunks of rubble tumbling at high speed onto the dance floor as avatars scattered to get out of the way. A gaping hole had just been blasted in the roof of the club near the top of the globe, and a small army of Sixers was now pouring through it, swooping into the club on jetpacks, firing blaster pistols as they came. Total chaos broke out. Half of the avatars in the club swarmed toward the exit, while the other half drew weapons and began to cast spells, firing laser bolts, bullets, and fireballs back at the invading Sixers. There were more than 100 of them, all armed to the teeth. I couldn't believe the Sixers' bravado. Why would they be dumb enough to attack a room full of high-level gunters on their own turf? They might kill a few of us, but they were going to lose some or all of their own avatars in the process. And for what? Then I realized that most of the Sixers' incoming fire seemed to be directed at me and Artemis. They were here to kill the two of us. The news that Artemis and I were here must have already hit the news feeds. And when Sorrento had learned that the top two gunters on the scoreboard were hanging out in an unshielded PvP zone, he must have decided that it was too juicy a target to pass up. This was the Sixers' chance to take out their two biggest competitors in one shot. It was worth wasting 100 or so of their highest level avatars. I knew my own recklessness had brought them down on us. I cursed myself for being so foolish. Then I drew my blasters and began to unload them at the cluster of Sixers nearest me, while also doing my best to dodge their incoming fire. I glanced over at Artemis just in time to see her incinerate a dozen Sixers in the space of 5 seconds, using balls of blue plasma that she hurled out of her palms while ignoring the steady stream of laser bolts and magic missiles ricocheting off her transparent body shield. I was taking heavy fire, too. So far, my own body shield was holding up, but it wasn't going to last much longer. Failure warnings were already flashing on my display, and my hit point counter was starting to plummet. In seconds, the situation escalated into the largest confrontation I'd ever witnessed, and it already seemed clear that Artemis and I were going to be on the losing side. I noticed that the music still hadn't stopped. I glanced up at the DJ booth just in time to see it crack open as the great and powerful Og emerged from within. He looked really, really annoyed.
"You jerks think you can crash my birthday party?" he shouted.
His avatar was still wearing a mic, so his words blasted over the club's speaker array, reverberating like the voice of God. The melee seemed to halt for a split second as all eyes turned to look at Og, who was now floating at the center of the dance floor. He stretched out his arms as he turned to face the onslaught of Sixers. A dozen tines of red lightning erupted from each of Og's fingertips, branching out in all directions. Each tine struck a different Sixer avatar in the chest, while somehow arcing harmlessly around everyone else. In a millisecond, every single Sixer in the club was completely vaporized. Their avatars froze and glowed bright red for a few seconds, then simply vanished. I was awestruck. It was the most incredible display of power by an avatar I'd ever seen.
"Nobody busts into my joint uninvited," Og shouted, his voice echoing through the now silent club.
The remaining avatars, the ones who hadn't fled the club in terror or been killed in the brief battle, let out a victorious cheer. Og flew back into the DJ booth, which closed up around him like a transparent cocoon.
"Let's get this party going again, shall we?"
he said, dropping a needle on a techno remix of Atomic by Blondie. It took a moment for the shock to wear off, but then everyone started to dance again. I looked around for Artemis, but she seemed to have vanished. Then I spotted her avatar flying out of the new exit the Sixer attack had created. She stopped and hovered outside a moment, just long enough to glance back at me. Chapter 19. My computer woke me up just before sundown and I began my daily ritual. "I'm up," I shouted at the darkness. In the weeks since Artemis had dumped me, I'd had a hard time getting out of bed in the morning, so I'd disabled my alarm snooze feature and instructed the computer to blast "Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go" by Wham. I loathed that song with every fiber of my being, and getting up was the only way to silence it. It wasn't the most pleasant way to start my day, but it got me moving. The song cut off, and my haptic chair reshaped and reoriented itself, transforming from a bed back into its chair configuration, lifting me into a sitting position as it did so. The computer began to bring the lights up slowly, allowing my eyes to adjust. No outside light ever penetrated my apartment. The single window had once provided a view of the Columbus skyline, but I'd spray-painted it completely black a few days after I moved in. I'd decided that everything outside the window was a distraction from my quest, so I didn't need to waste time staring at it. I didn't want to hear the outside world either, but I hadn't been able to improve upon the apartment's existing soundproofing. So I had to live with the muffled sounds of wind and rain and of street and air traffic. Even these could be a distraction. At times, I'd slip into a kind of trance, sitting with my eyes closed, oblivious to the passage of time, listening to the sounds of the world outside my room. I'd made several other modifications to the apartment for the sake of security and convenience. First, I replaced the flimsy door with a new airtight, armor-plated, vacuum-sealed war door. Whenever I needed something, food, toilet paper, new gear, I ordered it online, and someone brought it right to my door. Deliveries worked like this. First, the scanner mounted outside in the hallway would verify the delivery person's identity, and my computer would confirm they were delivering something I'd actually ordered. Then, the outer door would unlock itself and slide open, revealing a steel-reinforced airlock about the size of a shower stall. The delivery person would place the parcel, pizza, or whatever inside the airlock and step back. The outer door would hiss shut and relock itself. Then, the package would be scanned, x-rayed, and analyzed 8 ways from Wednesday. Its contents would be verified, and delivery confirmation would be sent. Then, I would unlock and open the inner door and receive my goods. Capitalism would inch forward, without my actually having to interact face-to-face with another human being. Which was exactly how I preferred it, thank you. The room itself wasn't much to look at, which was fine, because I spent as little time looking at it as possible. It was basically a cube, about 10 meters long on each side. A modular shower and toilet unit were embedded in one wall, opposite the small ergonomic kitchen. I'd never actually used the kitchen to cook anything. My meals were all frozen or delivered. Microwave brownies were as close as I ever got to cooking. The rest of the room was dominated by my Oasis immersion rig. I'd invested every spare cent I had in it. Newer, faster, or more versatile components were always being released, so I was constantly spending large chunks of my meager income on upgrades. The crown jewel in my rig was, of course, my customized Oasis console, the computer that powered my world. I'd built it myself, piece by piece, inside a modded mirror black Odinware sphere chassis. It had a new overclocked processor that was so fast, its cycle time bordered on precognition. And the internal hard drive had enough storage space to hold 3 digitized copies of everything in existence. I spent the majority of my time in my Shaptic Technologies HC5000 fully adjustable haptic chair. It was suspended by 2 jointed robotic arms anchored to my apartment's walls and ceiling. These arms could rotate the chair on all 4 axes, so when I was strapped into it, the unit could flip, spin, or shake my body to create the sensation that I was falling, flying, or sitting behind the wheel of a nuclear-powered rocket sled hurling at Mach 2 through a canyon on the 4th moon of Altair 6. The chair worked in conjunction with my Shaptic boot suit, a full-body haptic feedback suit. It covered every inch of my body from the neck down and had discreet openings so I could relieve myself without removing the entire thing. The outside of the suit was covered with an elaborate exoskeleton, a network of artificial tendons and joints that could both sense and inhibit my movements. Built into the inside of the suit was a web-like network of miniature actions.